welcome you to Amravati this afternoon. And this, we just completed, yesterday we finished a Christian and Buddhist retreat, a follow-up from last year's conference, intermonastic conference. We had a, starting last Monday and ending yesterday, the group of Christians and Buddhists, monks and nuns. Can everyone hear? It's a subtle system. And the interesting the interest, say, of people who live a religious life and yet who belong to different religious conventions, who've dedicated their lives towards a commitment to a particular a celibate life or kind of a total commitment to a particular religious form, and where the main experience is contemplative, and just what is the what is it that we are all aiming at? Because this is the question of the time. I think Christianity is going through a lot of investigation and confusion over what is the purpose and what is the real meaning of religion. Because I think last week in Sussex they forced a priest to leave his parish because he said something to the effect that he didn't believe in God, and so this is a way of thinking, maybe, that this idea of believing in religious doctrines, in which we adhere to beliefs or particular ways of talking or saying things or attitudes, and of course this tendency, this grasping, leaves us in a place where we end up just seeing that we're different, and those differences are you can't reconcile if you're just working on the level of convention. How can you say that the cross and the Dhammajaka, the wheel, are, I mean, they're just two obviously very different symbols, or they look different, and they have a different effect. You know, people look at a cross that has one effect, and the Dhammajaka has another. But one thing I became that I was interested in the Faith and Awakening Conference last September was the experience of silence. Silence is prayer, where the because in silence, say, we're this is a common, this is like the background of sound. This is the, this isn't that you can't say it belongs to anybody. You can't say silence is Buddhist or Christian, or that anyone has any kind of more right to it than anyone else. And it's where they, we can, when we begin to listen to silence, this is a new way of thinking, isn't it? Listening to silence. Because usually we think of listening to sound, listening to music, listening to somebody give a talk. But silence is, there's nothing to listen to. What's the point of it? Or we tend to feel very, some of those times when you meet somebody and then there's this, this very uncomfortable silence where you don't, neither of you not quite don't know what to say to each other, and you just feel embarrassed, or or ill at ease because of the silence, this silence that's there between us. Because in worldly life, we're usually, silence is something we see as something to ignore, something that is not worth bothering with. That it's important to think, to create, to do things, to fill spaces. If you see a space anywhere, fill it with something. You go in some of the old churches and Buddhist temples in Thailand and so forth. Any little place where there's a space, they have something in it, some little design of some sort. Because the idea was to fill space up with form, or to drown out the silence, to fill the silence with sound. And yet, now it's an interesting change. Say in human consciousness, there's a lot of emphasis on silence, on listening, on emptiness. These kind of words now are words that are beginning to mean something, a direction, or something to develop, something to pay attention to. Because one thing we can all say in modern life is that we've managed to, say, blast out silence and demolish space. We've created a society where we're endlessly busy. We don't know how to rest or relax or to just be. We're constantly intimidated by our own personalities, the driven quality of our lives, in which we've spent so much time with our clever minds developing a technology to make life easy, and instead we find ourselves stressed out by it. Time-saving devices, isn't they were called? Save women from standing, having to go down to the river to wash their clothes. Have a modern washing machine and have everything convenient, a push-button type of situation where you just stand there and push, or sit there and push the buttons, and what you want manifests. Tedious tasks are turned over to robots and machinery. And we have all the time then to just do what? What do we do with the time that we've saved? And that's not really a problem, because we find all kinds of things to do. In the thing that I think was very attractive to me with Buddhism was this emphasis on emptiness. Because this was an experience, I think, that we have in life, but we don't know how to, we don't know what it is, and we don't and it's not something that is considered like normal behavior, or that, I mean, the emphasis there is very much to become somebody, to have a personality, to be an interesting character, to be somebody who you can prove yourself, prove your worth, that you're, or in a very competitive way, to always feel that you have to be, you in order to be worth anything, you have to be better than somebody else. And the idea of being at the bottom of the pile, the worst one in the class, the hopeless case, the one without any personality. That was really a worry when I was a teenager. The worst thing you could say about somebody was they didn't have any personality. Back in the late 40s, if you really wanted to hurt somebody's feelings, you say, she doesn't have any personality. Little did I know that I'd be dedicating my life to developing a non-personality. But this isn't trying to destroy a personality or to criticize personality as something. There's something wrong with having one, but it is putting in. It's allowing a perspective on it in which we have a resting place, a refuge, because on the level of always having to prove ourselves or be somebody or always having something to do, keeping busy. Always having to fill up silence with sound or space with forms. This is the rat race, or the endless cycle of that we feel stressed by. It's a stressful experience. It's suffering. It's an anguishing, miserable state. Because sometimes in life when you're young and you have a lot of energy and things are going well, you can enjoy the pleasures of youth and good health and excitement and romance and adventures and all those kind of experiences. But yet, in many cases, those kind of experiences are suddenly stopped through maybe some kind of disability or we lose somebody that we're very attached to, or something happens to us, inevitably, that shakes us. And the kind of fascination for just the pleasures of the sense realm and the good health and the vigor and the good looks and the personality and the praise of the world, suddenly it becomes, we no longer can find happiness in it if it's still going on, or we feel embittered because somehow we've not been able to achieve the level of pleasure and success that we imagine we should have, that is our due, is our right. We see people around us, we think, we can feel disappointed or embittered, or we can blame all kinds of people or situations, the fact that we didn't get the best in life, we didn't get what we imagine we should have, and then we can feel embittered. So in contemplating the conditioned realm, say in terms of the contemplation on impermanence or the nature of conditioning, we begin to relate conditioning to the unconditioning. So, like the conditioning of your own mind, what is it? You contemplate, say, what is conditioning in regards to your own mental experience? And they have koans in the Zen koans about, what is your original faith or before you were born, and kind of enigmatic, reflective conundrums that make us stop and think first we think it's nonsense because we think of face is only as a physical face. But as we begin to say listen to the silence of the mind and to contemplate the space, say just visual space or timelessness, we begin to notice, say, the time, the perception of time is something that's conditioned into us. We're very strongly committed to the sense of the past, the present time as 2:15, and the future. So these are all pointing to the conditioning of the mind, the conditioned realm. The personality is conditioned into the mind. You're not born with a personality. To become a personality, you have to think. You have to conceive yourself as somebody. It can be good or bad. It can be all kinds of things, mixtures of everything. But it's the personality depends on being able to remember, have a past, have a history, have all kinds of views or assumptions about yourself, as whether you're attractive or unattractive, or you're lovable or not, you're clever or stupid, or all these things, and these can vary according to situations. But sometimes we're stuck with a kind of assumption, even maybe an unconscious assumption about ourselves as being somebody, some type of permanent thing or conditioned thing. But when we develop the kind of contemplative mind or the intuitive awareness of things, and we reflect on the way it is, we begin to experience the original mind. The words like original mind. What is the original mind, or the original faith, or the consciousness before it's conditioned by perception? And so when you try to think about it, you get caught in your analytical abilities. So it's beginning to watch and listen, that position, that kind of awakeness of the watcher, the silent watcher, the listener, the witness, rather than trying to become somebody who's enlightened. This is another thing that doesn't work, is to think, to meditate in order to become somebody who's enlightened. Doesn't work, because as long as you're trying to become somebody that's enlightened, you create yourself as a person that is unenlightened now, and then you do something now. Hopefully in the future you will become somebody else who you can say is an enlightened person. And so this is saying, just notice that, just pointing to how we tend to perceive and think about ourselves. How many of you think, we tend to say that the cultural attitude is to see yourself as, well, I'm an, unless you're a megalomaniac or a bit crazy, we all would tend to think of ourselves as a kind of not enlightened, or or people with problems, or we can say people with a lot of problems, or hopeless cases sometimes. Because sometimes we imagine the worst thing we can think about ourselves is the truth. We got a kind of perversity to grasp, thinking that real honesty lies in admitting the worst possible things about yourself. So this is just for reflection, contemplation. But the personality, how I use that word, is not trying to make any kind of judgments against personality, but to know what it is, so that you're not operating from the delusions you create around. And the assumptions you have about yourself as a person. So in order to do that, one listens to the silence, or one, like the stillness, learning to sit in a still way, like these Buddha images and meditation postures are just a way of say, stopping us from just restlessly moving around, fidgeting, or just going from here to there all the time, but learning to stop and sit still. Stillness, non-movement. Not that is going to make you enlightened, but it's going against, the momentum of habit and restless energies of the body and emotional restlessness. So just sitting still for a while, and then we say mindfulness, paying attention, awakeness, watchfulness. So we listen to the silence. And because I teach a lot around the sound of silence, the kind of ringing sound that we can hear, the kind of background of everything. If you develop the listening ability, you can even just think of it as just listening with your ears, and you can hear, or you can hear my voice, you can hear the sounds that of things that happen. But behind all that is a kind of like a high pitch, almost electronic buzz. And that I call the sound of silence. And I find that a very helpful way of, say, concentrating the mind. Because when one begins to notice that, and not as a something to, not as any kind of attainment or achievement, but merely it's a convenient method for, say, contemplation, in order to see or even to hear yourself think. Like thinking itself is a kind of sound, isn't it? When you're thinking, you can hear yourself thinking. I can hear myself thinking. So when I listen to myself thinking, it's like it's the same as listening to somebody else talking. And so I listen to the thinking of the mind, and the sound of silence. When I'm with the silence, the sound of silence, then I notice that I'm not thinking. There's a stillness there. So you note consciously. Note the stillness. And that will help you to begin to see to experience or begin to become acquainted or recognize the emptiness. So the emptiness isn't a kind of shut off or a denial of anything, but it's letting go of the habitual tendencies of just restless activity or obsessive thought, just going along with the momentum of your habits and desires. You can actually stop that momentum by listening. And in that, with the sound of silence, there's attentiveness, there's consciousness. You don't have to close your eyes. You don't have to plug up your ears or even ask somebody to leave the room, or you don't have to do it in a special place. Wherever you are, it seems to work. Very helpful in community life or in family life, where you can life can get very habitual and very kind of automatic, and we get used to each other. And then we tend to operate through all kinds of assumptions and habits that we don't even know about, we're not aware of. So the silence of the mind allows, say, the conditions to be what they are, and the ability to reflect on them in terms of arising and ceasing, and begin to see that all the perceptions and ideas we have about ourselves are conditions of the mind. That's not what we really are. What you think you are is not what you are. Then you say, well, what am I then? And say, do you really need to know who you are? You just need to know what you're not. It's enough. The problems are not that we think we're all kinds of things that we're not, and that's where we suffer. We don't suffer from anatta, from not being anybody. We suffer from being somebody all the time. That's where the suffering is. So when we're not anybody, it's not suffering. It's a relief. It's like putting down a heavy burden. If you be self-consciousness, concern, obsession with oneself, fears of what other people think, the whole lot that's connected to the sense of ourself, our personality, we can drop that. We can just let it go. What a relief. To not be anybody. Or not feel we have to, you know, that we're somebody now that is got all kinds of problems and hopefully we've got to do something. I should practice more meditation. I should come to Amaravati more often. Maybe I should become a monk or a nun. Because I've got so many problems. I've got to get rid of all this. And I can't do it. And all this is thought, isn't it? It's all kinds of assumptions about yourself. It's the critical mind. It's the discriminative mind that's always saying it's something you're not good enough or you've got to be better. So when you listen, say this listening is available to us at all the time. At first, maybe it's helpful to go through meditation retreats or situations where where you have reminders around you, where you're encouraged, where you're supported, where all of that is, where a teacher is there to kind of keep prodding you along, helping you to remember. Because it's easy to fall right back into the old habits, especially mental habits, because mental habits we're so used to and they're subtle. And the sound of silence after a while doesn't seem like anything. It's not worth listening to. It's not like Mozart or modern rock or anything like that. And some people are offended by the fact that monks can't listen to music. They think we should at least be able to listen to Mozart. You see, we listen to the silence. That sounds like a weird thing. But even music can listen to the silence behind the music as you begin to develop this practice, which doesn't destroy the music. Doesn't mean that Mozart suddenly you have to switch off the Mozart and listen to the sound of silence. But you're putting in a perspective where you're not just being carried away by the music or just being addicted to sound. But you can also appreciate sound and silence, because the middle way that the Buddha talks about isn't an extreme of annihilation. It's not saying silence, emptiness, no self, this is what we've all got to do. We've got to get rid of our desires, our personalities. We should, all the sense realm is an attack on silence. We've got to destroy all the conditions. All music, all forms, we should have any forms in this room. Just have white walls. to see the formed world always as a threat, as an attack on emptiness. That's not it. It's not taking sides for the conditioned or the unconditioned, but recognizing their relationship, which is an ongoing practice. And that's where mindfulness is the way, because it's in the state we're in on the planet Earth and the human bodies. We have a very strong conditioning to bear with. I mean, for the whole of our lifetime, we have to live within the limits and problems and difficulties of human body. And then we have emotions. We're not just kind of human mechanisms, but we also walk and eat and sleep and so forth, but we also feel everything. And we remember all kinds of things. And so we're in a state of this sensitive pleasure and pain experience for a lifetime within whatever happens around us and hits us or impinges on us as a living form. But we can see it in the right way. And this is the point the Buddha is making, to understand things as they really are. To be able to let things be what they really are, rather than create delusions around things. Because that's what we do. When out of ignorance, we're creating endless delusions around the things of our life, around our own bodies, around our memories, around the language, around the perceptions, views, opinions, the culture, the religious conventions, the whole lot. We create illusions around all of it. And so it becomes complicated, difficult, and separative. Isn't it at this time the alienation that modern people feel is this alienation of selfishness, where we're so full of ourselves, our own kind of sense of ourself is so important. It's been held up to us as this is what life is all about. It's about me getting what I want. We become full of our own self-importance. Even the fact we might think we're a hopeless case, we still give that tremendous importance. I mean, we can spend years going to psychiatrists to discuss the reasons for our own hopelessness because we're very important to ourselves. And that is also quite a natural thing for us, because what is more important, say, in terms of experience, is that we've got to be with this all the time. We can escape from other people, but we're always stuck with this. And even if we can blame the place, we think the place I live in is I can't bear anymore. I'm going on a holiday. We still take ourselves with us, off to Mallorca or someplace like that, planning a holiday from all the pressures of life, and we bring them. We can take them along with us because. The sense of ourself is something, say it's an emotional mental creation that we just can't leave behind at the office or in our house. So to put the self into perspective, so anatta or non-self isn't, I mean, many people misinterpret that and say it's a denial of self, a kind of putting down the self as something that we shouldn't have. But it's not. That's not how anatta works. Anatta, or non-self, is a suggestion to the mind. It's a tool to begin to reflect on what we really are. And in the long run, we don't find anything. We don't have to see ourselves in any way as being anything. Even the human body is no longer ours. I mean, if we take this reflection to its ultimate, then the body, the emotions, the memories, the whole lot that seems so definitely, so insistently ourselves, we begin to see in terms of they rise, they cease, because we're now aware of the cessation of things. And that is more real to us than the ephemeral conditions that we tend to be grasping or tend to be obsessed with. It takes a while to be able to get over the hump of this self-obsession. But you can actually do it. It's not something one can't do, but it does take a while because remember the habit tendencies are so strong, and the society we live in, and that's everywhere, not just Britain or Europe, but it's every country. There is acculturation is usually based on ignorance. There's no society based on wisdom that I know of. Even a country like Thailand, which is a Buddhist country, it's still basically its culture is an affirmation of the self. But they do offer the opportunity to to break through the illusion. But also, there are some psychologists and psychiatrists have commented that maybe we need a self. And this is an important thing to consider, is that a self is it's not something that we shouldn't have, but something we need to put in its proper place. And a self, say, based on the goodness of our lives, rather than a self that we create out of dwelling on the flaws and faults and negative tendencies of the mind. Because I notice it's so easy to see oneself in very critical ways and compare oneself to maybe to other people or to images or to historical people. Like comparing yourself to the Dalai Lama. I'm not as good as the Dalai Lama. I've met the Dalai Lama, but I've never lived very closely to him. I've met him briefly on kind of very formal occasions. But of course, somebody you don't live with, and that has a lot of, that is very famous and has good press, you build up into an icon, you see. Mother Teresa, I met her 2 years ago in Calcutta, but I've never lived with Mother Teresa. I've heard some people complain about her that have lived with her. But one can easily make icons out of these people, the living beings, or people of the past, like Mahatma Gandhi was one. I used to think, I'd like to be like Mahatma Gandhi. And then Mahatma Gandhi is quite candid about his own shortcomings and in his works, certainly admitting all kinds of weaknesses that some people that are Mahatma Gandhi enthusiasts really don't like to admit. I remember years ago, 20 years ago, I was in this place in India, an ashram there, where the people, there was an international group of people, and they were idolizing Mahatma Gandhi. And so they it was their kind of hero, a perfectly kind of super human being, a moral creature that was completely wise. And then somebody gave a talk on an incident in Mahatma Gandhi's life, which was not, you know, something that was not common knowledge, but was in the books. But it wasn't part of the image that didn't polish the image that was being created. And I remember one man being really angry, wanting to throw this man out of the ashram, saying he's a disciple of the devil trying to destroy goodness in the world because he wanted a Mahatma Gandhi that was like a shiny Buddha Rupa, maybe. Never tarnishes. So comparing ourselves always with ideals and the best that we can think of, we can only be critical with the way we are, because life is like this. It's a flow. It's change. It's feeling tired. It's having to deal with emotional problems. with anger, with jealousy, fears, all kinds of desires, all kinds of strange things that we don't want to admit even to ourselves, all kinds of different conditions that don't fit into the idealized being, our sense of purity and goodness that has no flaws in it at all. But it's not to see ourselves as being flawed, but to see that that's a part of the process, is to be able to recognize, to observe the nature of things, that conditions, whether they're good or bad or perfect, imperfect, are impermanent. They arise, they cease. And in this way, we keep learning and we find strength in our own, through our own karmic conditioning. So it's not a matter of being embittered by life because we didn't get the best in the beginning. Maybe we didn't get a very good deal at all in life. Maybe we got all kinds of physical problems, health problems, emotional problems. We could say maybe we really, you know, when we were passing out all the good traits, we weren't around. We were standing behind the door in the loo. We missed out. Or God loves them more than he loves me. God. People like to blame God for the fact that life isn't fair. But in terms of Dhamma, say these are not obstacles, because some of the, you know, it's many times these flaws and difficulties that force us into awakening to life. Because we recognize, and kind of some part of it realizes, that just trying to straighten up everything and make everything nice and order everything and make life pleasant is not the answer. We recognize that there's something more to life than just controlling it and trying to get the best of the conditions. And so this recognition of silence, silence as a prayer, as a way of letting go of our own position, a sense of ourself, our own convention, in order to be in the silence where there is unity. Because in silence is like the space in this room is the same for all of us. It's not, I can't say this space is mine. Oh, I can say things like that, but it's ridiculous, isn't it? Because it doesn't, you know, it looks just like the space where you are. It doesn't. Listen, see, this is Ajahn Sumedho space. It's only you can only say that when I'm sitting here. But space is just that. It's space. It's not. It's where the forms come and go. But it's something we can notice, we can contemplate. And what happens? A contemplating space, when the result of just opening your mind up to space, just visual space, you can see. But it's not like you can see it as anything, but it's space, it's just what it is. And as you develop awareness of space, then the result is that you do, you begin to have a sense of spaciousness, of infinity. Because, or a sense of maybe, or like infinity, because space has no beginning or end. I mean, you can build rooms and you can look at space as it exists in, as it is in a room like this, but you know that the building is in the space. So it's like infinity. It has no boundaries. But in our own limitation of visual consciousness, maybe boundaries help to see space in a room. Because space is infinity, is maybe too much. But as space in a room is enough to get the relationship of form to space, to observe, to contemplate, the relationship of the things, the forms in the space. And then the sound of the silence and your own thoughts as you listen. And you can deliberately think. Like I used to deliberately think thoughts, like in neutral thoughts, like I am a human being, which is, you know, it just a kind of neutral thought, doesn't arouse any emotional feelings. And just by listening to myself thinking that thought, it would be with the intention of listening to the thought as thought and the silence that it's in. So that this way you're kind of contemplating and recognizing the relationship of your thinking ability to the silence, the natural silence of the mind. And in that, then you're really establishing mindfulness, the ability and as a individual being to be a witness. To be the listener, to be that which is awake. Now, emotionally, this can be very difficult because we get very negative about it sometimes. Because emotionally we haven't resolved a lot of our desires to have things, to feel things, to get high, or to get rid of things, or to be obsessed with something. So this is where you listen even to your own emotional reactions. Just begin to notice when there is this silence, what happened emotionally. Emotions, I'm using the word emotions as a kind of that which arises in the mind, like negativity. What I don't know what I'm doing, or this is a waste of time, or the kind of doubting negative states that will arise around this practice. But you also listen to those emotions. They're just habits of the mind that by accepting them, by admitting them and accepting them, then they cease also. And more you the emotional reactions will fall away. And then you'll feel more confident in just being that which is aware. Establishing your life, say, with the intention, say, to do good and refrain from doing evil things. We need that self-respect. It isn't, this meditation doesn't come from the idea that you if you're just mindful, you can do anything you feel like. But it's respecting conditions, not just judging them, but respecting the body you have, your own humanity, your own intelligence, abilities to do things, to respect that. Doesn't mean to be attached or to identify, but it's recognizing that these are what we have. This is the way it is. These conditions are this way. Even respecting disabilities. When you talk to people who have have, you know, like people who have very obvious physical disabilities. It's interesting to hear how they, through meditation, can come to terms with maybe paraplegia. There's one friend in America who's quadriplegic. How to respect some disability like that doesn't mean that you know, because it's easy to identify with saying I am a quadriplegic, as a, you know, that's what everybody says. As the doctors say, you're a quadriplegic. Your parents probably say, well, you know, you're a quadriplegic now, and so you become fixated with the condition of your body, which means that you're a disabled person, and you can't, you know, and that means you're not normal anymore. You're not like the rest of us. There's something, you know, not as good because you're physically you're not, you don't have it all there anymore. So that's the self view. But self respect or respect for the conditions even means respect for the state they're in. Doesn't mean that liking it, but it means accepting it and learning to work with the limitations of it. So say within the enlightened mind, it's not a matter of having the best, is it? That you need to have the best health and the best conditions, the best of everything in order to really make it. Because that feeds the sense of yourself, you know, as being somebody who can only operate from having the very best of everything. But when we begin to realize that the disabilities or the flaws and the strange things that we each have are not obstructions anymore, because we've seen them in the right way, and we respect them. We're willing to accept them. We're willing to use them in order to see, to get beyond our attachment to them, to be free from identifying and from being attached to those perceptions of ourself as this or that. So this is a very, you know, marvelous thing that we can do as human beings. It allows us to use our lives as the whole of our life. It's an ongoing process, really. It's not a matter of age, because as you get older, it even gets more interesting. It's clearer. One of the advantages of getting old, it has advantages, especially on a spiritual path. So it's not something to dread, but to welcome and to respect. It's interesting now, and when you hear people complaining about life a lot, about how they were abused, or their life has been unfair to them, or that all kinds of injustices have been done to them, we can hear ourselves, you know, we can recognize that in ourselves. I mean, certainly, I'm quite capable of thinking like that myself. One time in my life, that was the way I thought. And you looked around and you think, life isn't fair. It shouldn't be like this. And we can endlessly create this a sense that life somehow should be other than what it is. But that, of course, is not the way life is. Life is like this. It's like the English weather. You never know what you're going to get from one day to the next. It's a continuously changing, dependent on other conditions that we have no control over. This state we're in of this human form, it's subjected to so many things all at the same moment. The effect of Jupiter and Mars, Pluto and Saturn and all the rest, the effects of the different galaxies and the and all the who knows what those are doing to us right now at this moment. Or it's the half moon, or it's the slaughter in Rwanda, all these things affect us in some way or another, and we're all kind of like belong in one thing. We're not. I mean, the self-separative self means that we get the idea that I'm completely independent from the rest, completely kind of cut off from the universe that I'm living in. And one can believe that illusion. You can cut yourself off through repression of your mind, through just as obsessions of your mind, as you attach to very limited views, very narrow-minded attitudes, very obsessive tendencies. You become, you have an appearance, you have a feeling of being completely cut off and isolated from everything. But that's an illusion only. That's an illusion we create in the mind. And it's a form of hell, isn't it? To just be stuck with the most kind of negative, narrow-minded illusions about yourself. So with meditation, then the opening of the mind to the whole universe. And it doesn't mean that if we take it personally, it would be too much to handle. But as we let go of the personality illusion, then we realize we're tuning in to the deathless. We're realizing we've returned, we've come home again, we're back where we belong, the deathless. And that means that that all the conditions and all their dependent and subtle forms and so forth, that's bearable for us. That we can endure. We have the ability to bear and to endure all that if we have the right attitude and right understanding. So I just want to encourage you in this to contemplate and to develop mindfulness of the silence, the background. They call it nada, which means not Spanish, it's Sanskrit. Means sound in Sanskrit, in Pali, and then it's in Spanish it means nothing. The Saint John of the Cross, he has a meditation on nada, and then it's also called shabda. And it's something that I found very helpful. To use, especially in an active life, even in an inactive life, but it will and to so that you have you kind of develop or you'd gain some confidence in contemplation and begin to get some perspective on your own thinking mind. Because that's where we delude ourselves all the time, is with our thinking mind. We're always thinking about things, trying to figure everything out. And then figuring it all out with the sense of me as a kind of underlying assumption, me trying to figure it all out. And then getting confused by all the complexities of our thinking. And well, so instead of trying to figure it all out in that way, which goes on and on and on and on, it becomes very complicated, then you're simplifying by recognizing this, the like with the sound of silence, you can actually begin to recognize the emptiness of the mind, the empty mind. And that's a place to turn to develop. Not as a not from the view of I've got to do it, but just as a way of to keep remembering that. So you eventually begin to have a perspective, and you can let go of all the obsessions of your mind. Not through an idea that you've got to do it, not through some kind of sense that you've got to get rid of these obsessions, but you're seeing the suffering, you're recognizing the suffering of being attached, and therefore your intention and your inclination is towards relinquishment. It's not towards getting rid of things out of aversion, but it's towards not carrying a burden anymore, freeing yourself from the burden that you've accumulated. So recognize how much of your life is a burden just through thinking about, worrying about tomorrow or things of the past or all this, about the endless kind of the guilt about maybe things you've done in the past, worrying about the future, about what's going to happen in the future, and or just the worry about people, about the family, about people we work with, about this or that. I mean, the mind just takes on and endlessly seems to move toward that. There's a habit of the mind to endlessly fill it up with the kind of negative states. And so to break the habit, then we're not trying to suppress the thought, but recognize thought and non-thought. Or sound and silence. So then you can think, but you're not just a thinker that goes on and on and on. You're not someone who has no refuge. It's just to you know that you have to get drunk in order to or take some kind of drug to stop thinking. But you can develop the way of understanding, seeing things as they really are. I want to offer this for your reflection, contemplation for this afternoon, and we can have a break, tea time, and I invite you all to have a cup of tea or whatever it is, and then in about 15 minutes, so we can all reassemble here for any questions or discussion. And then if any of you have any questions, I'll try to answer them. I'll talk around them anyway. Yeah, that's we need to have self-respect. We need to know, like in meditation, or the kind of foundation of it really lies in learning to understand what you really are, and your limits, in a sense of a self that you respect, and you can, and then that kind of self we is something that gives us the inspiration, the confidence. If we're just learning, if we just kind of don't like ourselves and we have a low self-esteem and then we're trying to get rid of it all, then it is a kind of, you know, we're just trying to annihilate ourselves, really. If, you know, we're just using anatta or the idea of not self as a way of just destroying ourselves, that won't work. But it's like, this is what I think in the Western world, especially in the European civilization, and in the sense of oneself oftentimes is we oftentimes see ourselves in very critical ways, as sinners or as people with a lot of faults, and sometimes we don't like ourselves very much, and that tendency is say if we're just using meditation as an annihilation, then it doesn't work. But keeping the sila, the moral precepts, and learning to and being kind and generous and things like this, then we begin to develop the good side, a sense of ourself as being somebody who's worthy, who we respect, who has some joy in their life. And that self, rather than just trying to hold on to the joy of one's own life, we're not trying to hold on to it, but we can relinquish it. In other words, we're not trying to get rid of it, but we're not using our life just for that anymore, because our goal is the ultimate realization rather than just happiness on the earth. It's very interesting, to say from my own experience as a monk over the years, having to deal with problem of like low self-esteem or a critical mind that was a kind of a tyrannical critic inside. This is my own experience. Just something in me was endlessly kind of criticizing me all the time. I used to think, you know, and I used to think of other people as, you know, this person has done this to me, and then I began to contemplate it. Nobody has ever been as relentlessly unkind to me as I have been to myself. Well, the suggestion, it's important to give that suggestion. Like, I don't find it helpful to give anyone the suggestion that they're worthless and hopeless, even if that's the case. Maybe, because it isn't, I find the idea of not self is a helpful suggestion. Or a positive sense. To point out that because the human state is a very blessed state in itself, whether you realize it or not, something else. But I mean, we do have so many gifts and potentials, and we need to remind ourselves of it, or we need people to remind us because we can forget. Like somebody in my position is people listen to. So it's important what I say. You know, to try to give the to say things that are going to help people rather than to harm them. Like if somebody in an authority position says, "Oh, someone like you could never meditate," you know, you could easily believe that. You know, if you could say, "Well, he Ajahn Sumedho says, I'm hopeless, I can't do it. And that could, you know, and one could just get stuck in that, with that. So that's why in teaching, you have to be really careful about, and not to come from a position of just emotional reacting to somebody and say something just as a kind of a criticism of them out of your own emotional feeling. Well, it's project. We create other people all the time, and it's you know you just you know like I last retreat I gave I had everyone I did this test I said okay now where is your mother right now and then I point out this. It's in your mind, isn't it? Even if she's dead. Because that's a perception in the mind, mother. And then each one of us has our own, you know, we have the same perception of mother, but the mother part's the same, but the face that comes up is, each one is different. Or the feeling it arouses of love or hate or whatever is different. But we're pointing to the fact that it's you know it's memory, it's perception, and it's not mother. And when we contemplate that, then we realize we create and we create you know like a prejudice is always a we think of a group of people like a race prejudice, and we think of them as in certain kind of stereotypes. Prejudice, stereotypes, and that we create in our mind. You know, it's something we create in our own mind. It's not anything other than a perception. And so you're looking at it for what it is, to see things as they really are. And it doesn't mean that those perceptions are wrong or that the image of your mother isn't anything wrong with it, but you're seeing it as perception rather than as your mother. You've seen it as a memory or the emotions that come from the memory. You're looking at it for what it is. You're not judging it and saying it that there's anything that you shouldn't have such a perception, but you're noting it for what it is. And this way you begin to, it's a way of learning to look at everything anew, even our own mothers, rather than always looking at them as through a veil of prejudices and memories and emotions. It's like learning how to drop it all and see completely anew, like see, a sense of beginning anew or renewal or here and now. Is suddenly we're not projecting onto each other all kinds of things every, you know. That's why sometimes it's more difficult to be around, say, something like our own mothers than around strangers, because we have all kinds of memories and feelings and attachments and that than we do around somebody else. Or why, when you've been married for so long, then you find somebody else more interesting. Because you don't know them very well. Well, it's not that we don't know, but we begin to see that what it is. And we still do that, but we're more aware of it in terms of what it is rather than just being caught up into it blindly. Because it's still, we can easily know this, and then when we meet our mother, get caught up in our emotions again and say all kinds of things. But also something in us is beginning we can remember also. And it's in that point of remembering, of mindfulness, that you're breaking through the habits, the cycle is being weakened. The habitual cycle is being weakened through mindfulness. It doesn't mean that it's all going to just disappear overnight, but its strength is being disempowered gradually. And more and more, like say with aversion, like I found people that I've had aversion to, through having bad experiences with them, and then I found that the mind would easily, even when I didn't see them for years or so, I could still get pretty angry just thinking about them, and then you know, they might have changed totally by this time, but just this memory of what they did 5 years ago. And this, so I noticed this, and then I realized, then you'd get into this state where you say, you should be able to forgive, you should be more compassionate, you shouldn't carry these things around. After all, I mean, you should be able to forgive. A Buddhist monk should have filled with metta and compassion and forgive people who have done him wrong. And that's the party line, you know, that's all very nice. But then you start thinking of them again, you get the same feeling. So then you realize that the memory itself is not the person. It's just a memory. And the memory, as long as you will always have that. I mean, it will always, if it's a bad memory, it'll always be a bad memory. Until you maybe see them again and develop good memories of them. But if you're just stuck with a negative memory, then it's always, you know, whenever you think of that person, that memory will be like that. It will always be maybe a bad memory. But you begin to see it in terms of what it really is. It's a memory of it's impermanent. It's not a self. And so in that way you break down the attachment to these memories and the belief that they're the habit that arouses the emotion. So then the anger and just through because of that, also to develop this meditation on emptiness and silence, so that you're always directing your mind not as a reaction, but as a determination to not get stuck in just indulgence and suppression of the condition, but turning away toward the silence, so that more and more the silence is your refuge. But it's not an attachment, and in that way, the power of those habits is you're not sitting kind of simmering away with all this stuff, because you're turning away from it, and that way the strength of that habit pattern begins to fade out. I'm sure. Because there's stories where people, there's a story of the man that Gamanita that spent the night in the potter's shed with the Buddha, and he was on his way to find the Buddha. And you see, by a certain chance, a rainstorm or something, he had to kind of, he couldn't get where he was going, and so he asked his potter if he could spend the night there. And he said, well, there's another man here. So he was in the same shed with the Buddha, and the Buddha talked to him, and then the Gamanita said, well, he thought he was just an old crank. I mean, it's like an idol is like this is what happens when somebody dies. You have this apotheosis. When somebody's dead, you tend to. I noticed this with my teacher Ajahn Chah. He's now apotheosized, and he's I lived with him for 10 years. And I lived with a human being, but then now how the mind works. Now that he's dead, and people that never knew him or never lived with him or hear the stories and that about him, then it tends to become, he becomes exalted. And this happened to Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Chah's teacher. Ajahn Mun, it sounds just like super bhikkhu, you know. And Dalai Lama, I heard him say this myself. Years ago, he came to London at Westminster Abbey, because the Dean Carpenter, who retired since, but he was a very, he really liked the Dalai Lama. So he invited him and gave him the kind of facilities at Westminster Abbey, and he was treated, you know, very well. And the Dalai Lama invited all the Buddhist monks one time to meet him in this beautiful old room in one of those buildings at Westminster. And I remember sitting there, and of course we were all filled with this idea, Dalai Lama and titles like that are very impressive. And of course, the Dalai Lama of Tibet, and you know, you're thinking he's reincarnated how many times, and he's the 16th of the lot, and he's, you know, and one has all these perceptions of this very special person with a title, reincarnated, and that. And then, but then when asked, he said, forget Dalai Lama. He said, it's just Tibetan culture. He says, I'm a bhikkhu. And so this is what he's talking to us. He says, I'm a monk, I'm a bhikkhu. And that gave me a lot of confidence in the Dalai Lama, because if there was that sense, I'm the Dalai Lama, and somehow, you know, I'm really special creature, my mind would be very suspicious. But because he didn't, and in this, he wasn't being falsely humble. This one felt that he's coming from the heart. That he saw himself, because when you're around him, he's not acting like he's somebody special at all. He's quite a natural, good-humored human being. You don't feel that he's trying to make out that you should bow to him, and that you've got to, that he's on a higher level than you are. I think that's one of the very appealing things about him, is that he seems very relaxed wherever he is. In those meetings in Wembley last year, you know, all those cameras and everybody, you know, in that conference center, everybody fixed on him. And he seemed always just to be completely at ease, you know.
Somebody asked him one question, and he just said, I don't know.
And have the determination, it's always a difficult thing to judge how far you ought to be saying ought to yourself, and how far you just want the discipline of determination.
Well, that's learning how to think, really, because ought and should is that's a mental that can be a skillful kind of way of encouraging one to do something, but when it becomes obsessive, you see, when we attach to that, then it becomes a problem for us, because we get into the mode of we always should be doing something, you know, it just becomes an emotional habit with us. We're compulsive. It becomes compulsive. But it, as a reflection, it's good. Like in the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, you have three aspects to each truth, and they go like this. The first one is there is suffering, as the first noble truth. Then the second aspect is suffering should be understood. So you're using that form of it should be understood. And then the third aspect is suffering has been understood. So it's a kind of formula and a way of contemplating. But when we take it on a personal level of I should understand suffering, then it can become a kind of compulsive obsession in which we don't see what we're doing anymore. It's interesting to observe how meditation can be, you get into, you should meditate, and you should practice so many hours a day, and you shouldn't talk, and you should, and all these shoulds in this life, this monastic life, and at first this is, you're quite willing, you agree with it all, you should do all these things. But then, and then you have maybe in the beginning, you have the inspiration, the energy, the faith, the all these things that you can try to do all these things that you should be doing. But then, after a while, things change, and you lose that kind of that inspiration, and because so much of that is feeding the sense of me as a person that's going to do all these things in order to get something that I imagine I should get if I do them. And then you end up not getting them. And you think, you're not practicing hard enough. You should practice harder and things like this. That's an inner tyrant. It's always, it's always saying, you shouldn't have said that. You should have done something else. And this was, I've told people before about this kind of reoccurring dream I had for the first several years of monastic life. Because I went through, university. And during that time, 6 years of university training, where this kind of compulsiveness was fixated on me, where you're always preparing for the next exam, you see. So in the monastic life, I found out that I was I'd be dreaming. I'd go to sleep, and then I'd dream that I was going into a coffee shop, and then the voice would say, "You shouldn't be here. You should be studying for the exam." And then it would change. The theme would be just like that, but it would, like one time I'd go into a pastry shop. And this is at a time when the place I was in, the food wasn't very good. And so you had this incredible kind of fantasies around sweets. And so I go into the pastry shop and order all these nice pastries. And then the voice would say, "You shouldn't be here. You should be studying for the exam." And so then I wake up and I think, this dream's trying to tell me something. It's because I'm not practicing hard enough. Or I'm not a good enough monk yet. I've got to be a better monk, I'm going to be tested. And so I kept the whole kind of conditioning of the mind was very much like this. But it kept going, and I kept having this dream, and I kept contemplating, what's the meaning? What's it trying to tell me? Because no matter how hard I'd practice, the dream would still go on, you know. It never satisfied that. You know, no matter how good you tried to be, you couldn't be good enough according to that dream. So then it kept kind of simmering away in my consciousness. And then one day I figured it out. And then I realized what the insight was that there wasn't any exam. And I never had the dream again. And that's frightening, because we don't know what's going to happen. Where with the exams, you kind of know. I mean, you kind of think you know anyway. You're used to that. We're used to living our lives always preparing for the future. But to really trust in the moment, we're not used to that. So that doesn't seem like, it seems like nothing. You know, it's frightening. What am I supposed to do? Just sit here? I'm not supposed to meditate or try or anything? That's how the opposite reaction. But that's oftentimes the reaction to this compulsiveness. And then we think, heck with it. You know, I mean, this life is just causing me misery. And then one wants to just go out and do everything, you know, follow every little impulse, or just chuck it all in, you know, throw in the towel. Think you can't do it is the opposite reaction. Well, that's where we need to change. We can't expect the society to help us, because it's not we are the society, so we need to do it ourselves. So I mean, if you think that a lay person can't do it, then probably that you can't. But it's better to assume that you can't. Because you can, and the society will change for the better when we do that. But remember, we're the society. Well, sometimes we want the society to change, but it's a reflection of what we are, really. And here in Britain, you know, it has a lot of good. It has a lot of, you know, for a worldly society, it is quite stable, and it has a lot of good things in it. But we need to, you know, we realize that now's a time where we're no longer asking, we no longer expect the government to solve all the problems and make everything right. We realize maybe we've got to do something now for ourselves and the society. Well, I think so much in the past it was, we were always hoping the next prime minister or the government, you know, they'd do it, get it all together for us and make everything right. And we know that is impossible. We can't expect that anymore from a government, because it the government reflects the way we are. And as we develop, then the government will increase that possibility within the positions of power, political power. But I've seen the futility of just endlessly complaining about